Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Solicitor General Elena Kagan once called Supreme Court confirmation hearings a vapid and hollow charade. Today, she enters the third day of her own hearings. She spoke this morning about the importance of judicial precedents.
Even if a particular justice might think that a particular result is wrong, that justice actually should say to herself, maybe I'm wrong. And maybe the greater wisdom is the one that's been built up through the years by many judges in many cases.
So how has it looked so far? We'll look at the nominee, the questions, and the issues. This hour On Point, the confirmation hearings of Supreme Court nominee Elena Kagan. And you can join the conversation. Have you been following the hearings? Do you think that you have a sense of the nominee? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Dahlia Lithwick. She's senior editor and legal correspondent for Slate and a contributing editor for Newsweek. Dahlia Lithwick, nice to have you with us.
Thank you for having me, Jane.
And also joining us from South Bend, Indiana, is Richard Garnett, professor of law and associate dean at Notre Dame Law School. He clerked for former Chief Justice William Rehnquist. Rick, nice to have you with us as well.
Thank you, Jane.
And also with us from Thousand Oaks, California, is Kermit Roosevelt. He's a professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania, and he clerked for former Supreme Court Justice David Souter. His latest book is Conflict of Laws. Kermit Roosevelt, thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Jane. Glad to be here.
I'll begin our roundtable today with a line from New York Senator Chuck Schumer, who likened these confirmation hearings to eating spaghetti with a spoon. A lot of work, he said, but not terribly satisfying at the end. So, Dahlia Lithwick, your initial thoughts about the Elena Kagan hearings so far?
Well, Jane, probably there's no one alive more cynical than I am about the value of these hearings. Well, I correct that. I guess Elena Kagan's Law Review article from 15 years ago suggests she may be more cynical than even Schumer and myself. But I generally find these things to be a fairly sort of empty piece of theater. But I have to say, just sitting in that hearing room for the last couple of days, I've been fairly impressed. I think as these hearings go, she's still not answering questions. Let me be clear. She's still not telegraphing any serious views. But I still think this has been a fairly substantive and quite in-depth discussion of some really important constitutional issues. And so all told, and certainly as compared to the last few I've seen, I think this is devoid of some of the really ugly, you know, racial and gender stuff that we saw last year in the Sotomayor hearings, and generally pretty substantial and focused on the issues.
Professor Garnett, do you agree?
To an extent. I think her criticism in 1995 of the hearings might have been a bit over the top. Certainly, I agree with Dahlia that they're generally unsatisfying. And, you know, to be fair to these nominees, they probably would like to tell us more in some instances, but they've been well coached by handlers to tell us less. It has been nice, as Dahlia said, that we haven't seen sort of ugliness of the kind that at least I saw in the Alito hearings, where really vicious personal attacks kind of marred the proceedings. But I guess what I'm still waiting to hear in her case, as I think many of us were in the earlier ones, is something about the criteria that she's actually going to use to apply these fairly general standards that she's holding out there. So she says, and we all believe this, that it's law all the way down and judges have to follow the law and not make it, and, you know, the precedent matters, and that's all well and good. We all want judges to defer and be modest, but sometimes judges don't defer, and sometimes they have to override what the political branches do, and I think I want to know, when is she going to do that?
Kermit Roosevelt, are you waiting to hear that as well?
I would love to hear that. I'm afraid we're not going to get it. I've sort of given up on the confirmation hearings as a way of learning about the nominee. I think they tell you something that's a little bit interesting about what the senators think is mainstream America's view of appropriate judicial behavior. So you'll see senators asking the nominee to commit to a particular principle or position. Of course, the nominee won't do that. The nominee will hedge and dance around. But you get a sense of where mainstream American legal culture is. And I think it's nice to have something that focuses public attention on the Supreme Court, on what we want a justice to do, on what cases people think were good or bad. You don't learn anything about the nominee, really, but you do learn something about American legal culture.
Yesterday, Republican Senator Jeff Sessions quoted Vice President Biden's chief of staff Ron Klain's assurances to the Democratic Party's left about exactly the kind of justice that Elena Kagan would be. Here's that.
Do you agree with the characterization that you are a legal progressive?
Senator Sessions, I honestly don't know what that label means. I've worked in two Democratic administrations. I love my good friend Ron Klain, but I guess I think that people should be allowed to label themselves.
Dahlia Lithwick, she, however, did not offer a label of herself, did she?
No, she didn't. And she's carefully resisted doing anything that would put herself in any kind of box, not just political or ideological, but also judicial and philosophical. I mean, she's trying very, very hard to say, look, I am who I am, but let me tell you who I am, but also I'm not going to tell you who I am. So there's a little bit of that shucking and jiving that you always get. But I think that one thing, and I guess this is where I disagree a little bit with Kim Roosevelt. One thing I'm seeing here is that you do get a sense from her answers, Jane, that she is a pragmatist. She is a centrist. She is striving for narrowness and consensus. And so I don't think it's completely valueless. I think over the couple of days, you do get a sense of how her mind works and how her brain approaches legal problems. And I think that's not inconsequential, even if it doesn't come with a label affixed to
pragmatist,
it.
Pragmatist, centrist. Let's hear a little bit more from her opening statements, from her own words. Here is Elena Kagan talking about the court, the Supreme Court, needing to be deferential to other branches of the government, especially the legislature.
The Supreme Court is a wondrous institution. But the time I spent in the other branches of government remind me that it must also be a modest one, properly deferential to the decisions of the American people and their elected representatives. What I most took away from those experiences was simple admiration for the democratic process. That process is often messy and frustrating. But the people of this country have great wisdom, and their representatives work hard to protect their interests.
Modest, deferential. Dahlia, you hear pragmatist, a centrist in Elena Kagan. Rick Garnett, what sense are you getting?
Well, like Elena Kagan, I think these labels are often unhelpful. I mean, from where I sit, Elena Kagan, I feel like I do have a good sense of what her legal philosophy is at a high level of generality, and she is, as Mr. Klain said, a legal progressive. I mean, you know, what one thinks is moderate depends on where one is. I feel like she tells us a lot about her approach to judging at a high level of generality when she invokes admiration for, as she should, for her boss, Justice Marshall, for Aaron Barak. When she says that she thinks that judges should defer to Congress when Congress takes steps to address difficult challenges, I hear in that a pretty clear indication that she believes, for example, the court made a mistake in the Citizens United campaign finance case. I hear in that a pretty clear signal that she's not going to be reaching out to strike down the health care initiative. Deference on those kind of matters is associated, I think, with the current progressive position on the spectrum, and I expect we won't see so much deference from her if it's a case about abortion or school choice or something like that.
Kermit Roosevelt, the themes of fairness and this notion that courts are a place where all people have access to justice is something that she's talked about a couple of times during these hearings.
Yeah, I think that's very true. You know, it's one of the nice things that people say about how they'll behave as judges. What I really hear listening to Elena Kagan in these hearings is, you know, I hear basically the same things that John Roberts said. And, you know, he promised to be a deferential, minimalist judge. He talked about the importance of modesty and restraint. And, you know, he's turned out to be pretty aggressive in some areas. So, I mean, really what I would ask Elena Kagan if I were there is, you know, you sound a lot like John Roberts. Are you going to be a different kind of judge? How can you explain disagreement among judges when everyone wants to be such a modest, impartial umpire?
Here she is today responding to a question from Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota on the similarities between judges and umpires.
You expect that the judge, as you expect the umpire, not to have a team in the game. In other words, not to come onto the field rooting for one team or another. You know, if the umpire comes on and says, you know, I want every call to go to the Phillies, that's a bad umpire. You know, to the extent that what the umpire suggests, that there's got to be neutrality, that there's got to be fairness to both parties, of course that's right.
Richard Garnett, the issue of Elaynik Hagan's lack of judicial experience, has that been an issue with the Judiciary Committee so far?
I haven't heard much of it. There's been some of that talk kind of out in the blogs and such. I know that for my own part, of course, I'm maybe biased here because I worked for a justice who had not been a judge before. I think that's kind of a non-factor and not likely to go anywhere. I mean, anybody can see that she's very able and intelligent and has a good temperament. I think the question isn't, has she been a judge before, but what kind of philosophy will she bring to bear on her judging as she goes forward. I think her discussion of the umpire image was actually pretty sophisticated, and I know some people have made fun of that image, but I think that's actually what the same thing that Chief Justice Roberts was trying to communicate. It's not that legal questions are easy, but it is that you want to make sure judges don't have skin in the game when they're deciding cases.
We did hear about that from Justice Roberts, did we not, Dahlia?
We did. In fact, I think that once he coined the umpire analogy, it's become de rigueur for everyone to invoke it ever after. And I do think, and I guess I differ a little bit with Professor Garnett, that the implication was that somehow it was easy. And I think that she did a good job today of saying, you know, it's not easy at all.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about Supreme Court nominee Elaynik Hagan and her confirmation hearings. We're speaking today with Dahlia Lithwick, senior editor and legal correspondent for Slate, Rick Garnett of Notre Dame Law School, and Kermit Roosevelt at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. At the confirmation hearings yesterday, Senator Lindsey Graham asked Solicitor General Kagan what she was doing on Christmas Day in relation to the attempted al-Qaeda bombing of a flight to Detroit on Christmas of 2009. Here is her response.
You know, like all Jews, I was probably at a Chinese restaurant.
Great answer.
Dahlia, personable, funny, most of the time, actually appears like she's quite enjoying herself.
Yeah, that's, you know, to me, the big difference between at least the last two, the Sam Alito and Sotomayor hearings last year, is that she looks like she's completely in command of the room. She really, you get a weird sense, even after a marathon, 10 hours yesterday, that she's kind of having a good time. And she doesn't defer all that much. Sometimes she cuts off the senators when she feels they're not hearing her out. She's not nearly as timid as other nominees. There's a way in which this proceeding, the incentive is for the nominee to make themselves seem very small and not threatening at all to anyone. She's quite the opposite. I think she's somebody who it's been hard to love in the last couple of months, unless you knew her. She's kind of busted out and really taken over the room in some ways and proven herself to be funny and affable and self-deprecating. And senator after senator down the line has commended her on just being funny and charming, and why that matters on the Supreme Court, I'm not clear on, but certainly she doesn't appear to be scared or nervous at all.
Here was another point in the hearings this morning where Elaynik Hagan, she declined an invitation to criticize the current Supreme Court. She says, I'm sure everyone up there is acting in good faith, quote unquote. In a lengthy exchange with Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, she pointedly did not agree with that Democrat's analysis that justices who were appointed by Republican presidents were, quote, driving the law in a new direction by the narrowest possible margins in a series of 5-4 rulings. What do you make of that kind of a comment, Kermit Roosevelt?
Well, I think she's right that everyone is acting in good faith. And that's one reason why I think the umpire analogy is of limited use, because you're not going to get someone up there who says, I want to advance the interests of the Republican Party. How can I do it? You're going to get people who honestly, sincerely, in good faith, have different approaches to judging, who think it's appropriate for the court to be deferential on some questions. You know, she might think this about questions of federal power, you know, but more aggressive on other questions. She might think that about some questions of individual rights. And what you need to try to figure out, I think, is when the justice would be assertive, when the justice would push back against government, and when they would say, I trust the government, I'm going to let them mostly have their way here. And that's, you know, that's really the key question that we're not getting at. And it's something that the umpire analogy really doesn't bring us much closer to.
Here she is yesterday facing tough questions from specifically Senator Jeff Sessions of Alabama over her policy of denying military recruiters access to Harvard Law School's Office of Career Services when she served there as the law school's dean. Harvard had long imposed these limits because the military's don't ask, don't tell policy violated the school's anti-discrimination policy. Here she is.
I tried to make clear in everything I did how much I honored everybody who was associated with the military on the Harvard Law School campus. All that I was trying to do was to ensure that Harvard Law School could also comply with its anti-discrimination policy, a policy that was meant to protect all the students of our campus, including the gay and lesbian students who might very much want to serve in the military, who might very much want to do that most honorable kind of service that a person can do for her country.
I'm just a little taken aback by the tone of your remarks because it's unconnected to reality. I know what happened at Harvard. I know you an outspoken leader against the military policy. I know you acted without legal authority.
Richard Garnett, the recruitment matter is one of the few points on her resume that Republicans have been able to use against her. How did she handle these exchanges?
Yeah, I thought she handled them well. I guess from my own perspective, I would advise the Republican senators to have a different target because I think there are some that are more promising for them. I mean, this was a case where clearly she had a substantive, deeply held policy disagreement with the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. And like many other law school deans at elite schools, she was trying to find a way to go with another policy. And she litigated in support of her views, as many other law school deans did. I mean, I just don't think it's very likely that a justice is going to be not confirmed because of a substantive policy disagreement with the federal statute. So I thought she handled it as well as it could be handled. At the end of the day, sure, she has to say, but of course she believes this, that the policy is wrong, she thinks. If there are enough senators who are deeply offended by that to vote against her, well, I'll be surprised. I mean, Senator Sessions seemed disappointed with the tone. I didn't think the tone there was problematic. I mean, for me, the tone questions with Solicitor General Kagan are more the kind of snarky things we saw in some of her law clerk memos and her emails from her days in the administration. Again, that's pretty typical for a political person, I think. But that might tell us more about whether she's actually got a bad tone than how she behaved in this Don't Ask, Don't Tell litigation. Mm.
Our calls are lining up here. Let me get a few in. Phyllis is on the line from Charleston, South Carolina. Hi, Phyllis. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call. Uh-huh. All I wanted to say was that, you know, the woman's a human being, and I don't think we're really going to know what she's going to do until she does it. I think that's always the case, and they're just going through the traditional posturing and hearings and other things that have to be done because of the system.
Phyllis, thank you. Dahlia Lithwick, this just is the way it goes. We don't get much out of these hearings, Phyllis says, but we just have to listen to them anyway.
Well, I think I'm going to – I sound very contrary today, but I think I might push back on Phyllis just a little because I do think that – and I guess I said this already, but I do think that in this case we're getting a fairly good sense of her as a human being. And I'll even echo what Rick just said and said some of that snarkiness and sort of lack of deference that you see in her Clinton memos, you even caught yesterday at the hearing. I mean, she is not a shrinking violet, and I think she's giving us a fairly good sense of what kind of human being she is. She's funny. She's definitely irreverent. She's not terribly patient. She doesn't always hear people out. But I think that unlike some of the nominees who render themselves into sort of cartoonish versions of umpires, you're getting a sense of a full human being in this hearing. And maybe I'm just, you know, a captive audience and I've been there too long, but it seems to me she's giving us some indication of what this person is really like.
Phyllis, thanks for the call. Here's David in Marblehead, Massachusetts. Hi, David. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I gather that some of the senators have alluded to Alina Kagan's background having grown up in the Upper West Side of New York. And I would like to get a sense from the panel about what they think is being alluded to there. I mean, I have a very clear idea of what I think is being alluded to there.
And what do you think, David? What do you think it is?
What do I think? Well, I think that if Alina Kagan were black, and they were alluding to the fact that she grew up in Harlem, we would be definitely alluding to something about her ethnic background and how that renders her somehow unrepresentative. And for this, the same complaint to be made about this Jewish woman who grew up on the Upper West Side of New York, which is a famously Jewish neighborhood, I think that something is being implied there that is not very pleasant.
All right, David, thank you. Kermit Roosevelt, what do you say?
Well, I would be inclined to give people the benefit of the doubt on that. I mean, I'd be inclined not to impute any sort of insidious motives to them. I think the question of the relevance of background is an interesting one. You know, I think actually having diverse life experiences on the court is a good thing, not because it changes the way people view the law, but because it gives them a different understanding of the facts to which the law is going to be applied. So if we're concerned that we've got too much of an East Coast court, you know, I could see that as a legitimate topic for conversation.
Richard Garnett?
Yeah, I agree with Kim. I mean, we heard in the lead-up to the nomination that one of the things the president was looking for was diverse life experiences, someone who could, you know, bring to the court's deliberations perhaps some different perspectives and so on. And I do think it's fair to say that in Solicitor General Kagan's case, we have someone who's been through sort of all of our elite institutions and, like several other justices, is from New York. And maybe there's kind of a not-so-subtle invocation of kind of, oh, those elites. Again, I certainly hope it's not any kind of reference to the Jewish character of the neighborhood. I would think of it as more being that some people in America have a sense that New York's kind of out of touch or whatever. But
let's hear actually more from the hearings this morning. Supreme Court nominee Elena Kagan discussing her previous service in government and how the role of a judge is different.
When I was a policy aide, I was not primarily looking at things as a lawyer. And even as a White House lawyer, you are a lawyer for a particular administration's perspective and a lawyer for a president who's trying to achieve a certain set of goals. As a judge, you are on nobody's team. As a judge, you are an independent actor, and your job is simply to evaluate the law and evaluate the facts and apply the one to the other as best, as most prudently, as most wisely as you can.
Kermit Roosevelt, if confirmed, how might Elena Kagan change the makeup of the court? Is she the new swing vote? I mean, how do you see it? Where would she stand?
Well, it's a little bit hard to pin her down. I mean, I think we can sort of approach that question best by looking at the justice she's replacing, Justice Stevens, and asking, where is he distinctive? How might she stack up there? And the thing that leaps to mind for me, really, is this question about executive power in the war on terror. Because Stevens had a very distinctive, quite strong, quite suspicious of government, pro-individual liberty position there. And there's no particular reason to think that Kagan would follow in his steps there. And in fact, you know, as Solicitor General, she's been defending some of the Obama administration policies that are quite similar to the Bush administration policies that Stevens was trying to push back against. So I think there we could see quite a dramatic shift, actually. We could see the court move to the right in terms of executive power in the war on terror.
Dahlia Lithwick, do you agree?
I agree wholeheartedly. I think that she might be also, certainly her early writings suggest she may be to the right of Stevens on issues like campaign finance reform and on free speech issues generally. I mean, the truth is this is where not having a vast judicial record really comes into play, because we really are trying to read the tea leaves of a handful of law review articles. And as she said in that clip you just played, a bunch of policy memos she wrote when she was answering to someone else. So she is much, much more inscrutable than some of the nominees we've seen who have years worth of judicial records and really have telegraphed to us where their heads are at on each of these constitutional issues.
Professor Garnett, with no paper trail on Elena Kagan, how do you see that point?
Yeah, I would probably just be echoing what my friends have said. I mean, I think it's the case that in some areas we might see some departure from where Justice Stevens has been. A sort of a third data point might be. She suggested in a few memos and writings that she might be more friendly to free exercise of religion claims than Justice Stevens often was. I'm not sure I agree that there's no paper trail. It's a different kind of paper trail. She's done academic writing. She's done, you know, law clerk and political operative writing.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, coming from a law school background, I'd love to see all the memos that she writes to her faculty.
That would tell you a lot. Sean is on the line now from Woodbury, Connecticut. Hi, Sean. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me in.
Sure.
A question that seems to me is sort of the elephant in the room that nobody seems to be talking about. An observation and a question. You know, the country was founded by adherents to the Protestant religion and philosophy, and all of the initial Supreme Court justices were Protestants by both religion and philosophy. And if Kagan gets through, this will be the first time in the history of this nation that there would not be a Protestant. And I see the religion as much a religion as a philosophy on the Supreme Court, and I think that's meaningful. I think people really do care about that, and I think it's sort of coming through in little ways, like the references to the Upper West Side. I think people are concerned that the Supreme Court will be entirely composed of Catholics and Jewish people, and there will be no Protestant representation on the court. I think it is the elephant in the room, and nobody seems to be talking about it, and I'd like to know why you think nobody seems to want to go there. It's a relevant topic. It's an intellectual topic as much as anything else.
Sean,
and
thank
I'd
you.
Like to hear about that.
I appreciate your call. Dahlia Lithwick.
It's such a good question that Sean asks, and I think the real answer, it's probably not the one he wants to hear, is that there was a time when the religious composition of the court was terrifically important. There was historically a Catholic seat. There was a sense that there had to be, after some point, a Jewish seat. The fact that there are now six Catholics and soon to be three Jews on the Supreme Court has gone almost unnoticed because I think religion isn't as important a distinguishing factor as it used to be. There used to be terrible anxiety in this country that the court be regionally representative and that there was a California seat and that there was a Southern seat. That's also gone. I think it's been replaced by our new anxieties today. Today we worry about race and gender and probably sexual orientation, and I do think that there's a sense in which those are the last century's battles and the new battles are over these identity politics that have more to do with race and gender. So I simply think it's not so much that nobody wants to talk about it. It's just that it doesn't make people anxious the way it did, say, 100 years ago.
Professor Roosevelt, how do you see it?
Yeah, I agree with Dahlia. I think it's hard to come up with much of a theory about how adherence to one religion rather than another is going to affect your judging. And I think people are more aware of that. There certainly would be some interest maybe if you had the question, is she religious or is she not? You know, is the Supreme Court composed of religious justices or non-religious justices? But I think we've got enough sort of religious pluralism and diversity and tolerance now that as Dahlia said, people don't think that that's such a significant factor anymore.
Professor Garnett, your thoughts here before the break. The religious composition of the court, should it be of concern?
Yeah, I wrote a couple newspaper pieces on this a few months ago. I guess I would assure the caller that there certainly will be Protestants on the court again. I regard the current composition as sort of an interesting effect of some changes in the legal academy, changes in that reflect kind of immigrants who were once excluded from some of the elite law schools, and the kind of credentialing positions that were necessary to get on the court are now in those positions. And then a big factor here is just that we had Republican presidents who were looking for justices who might be pro-life. After Roe versus Wade, a lot of Catholics moved from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party. They were available for Republican presidents to pick, and that's kind of shaking its way out now through the system. This will cycle in and out. There's not going to be a no Protestants need apply sign on the Supreme Court.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We are speaking today about the confirmation hearings for Supreme Court nominee Elena Kagan, and you can join the conversation. We're speaking today with Rick Garnett of Notre Dame Law School and Kermit Roosevelt at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, also Dahlia Lithwick, senior editor and legal correspondent for Slate and contributing editor at Newsweek. Many comments on our Facebook page and on our web page. From Facebook, Judy Redu says, I'm blown away by Elena Kagan, not only struck by her smarts, but her unflappable calm and wit and palpable warmth. President Obama hit this appointment out of the park. Judy, thanks. Here's from our webpage, onpointradio.org. Ellen Dibble says, Elena Kagan is for televising the Supreme Court proceedings. How about that? Does she think she's the deciding vote tending her way? She sounded like she thought it might come true. Who decides? Dahlia Lithwick? Who does?
The justices decide, and by my count, there's still only three who've suggested that they want it. So I think it may be we may be a while away. I think Kim will confirm that. I think it was Justice Souter who was the most opposed to cameras at the Supreme Court. I think he said they would roll them in over his dead body. So I think maybe the last bulwark of absolutely loathing the idea might have left the court. But it seems to me that the majority of the justices are still opposed.
Richard Kermit?
Yeah, that sounds right, what Dahlia says. I suspect Solicitor General Kagan knows that the senators probably like to hear that the nominee wants the proceedings to be televised, and she knows just as well that many of her colleagues on the court don't, and so I don't expect any changes anytime soon.
Here's another call from Wellesley, Massachusetts. Hi, Paul. You're on the line. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I love it when you host the program.
Oh,
I have two quick comments. Number one, in terms of finding out about the nominee, I find these hearings to be pretty well worthless. I think if there was anything about her that would actually prevent her from being confirmed, that would have come out before these hearings, and the hearings would never take place. But what I do find real value is that I think these hearings give our politicians, our senators, an opportunity to discuss and debate what they believe is the correct role for judges in our democracy. And in particular, from my point of view, I think it's terrific that the Democrats have been able to really call lie to this notion that the conservative justices are somehow exercising judicial restraint, and it's only progressive justices that are judicial activists. I heard a statistic the other day that Clarence Thomas has voted to overturn a law passed by the legislative branch of various governmental bodies more times than the four members of the so-called progressive bloc combined. And I think it's very important that the message get out there that, as one of your guests pointed out, that the Roberts Bloc has been very, very aggressive about imposing their beliefs on and not been deferential to the other branches of government.
Paul, thank you. Thank you very much. Kermit Roosevelt, your comments.
Yeah, I actually pretty much agree with that. I mean, I think one of the interesting things about this hearing is that it's been following pretty much the same script as the immediately preceding ones, where activism is presented as something bad and restraint and humility and modesty are presented as something good. But for the first time, we're seeing the Democrats trying more aggressively to push back against the idea that it's the liberals who are the activists and the conservatives who are restrained. And they're trying to get a lot of mileage out of the Citizens United decision.
Mm. Let's hear from Democratic Senator Herb Cole of Wisconsin. He is asking Elena Kanin, this is yesterday, about her method of interpreting the Constitution.
Justice Scalia considers himself to be an originalist who interprets the Constitution by looking solely at the text. He rejects the notion of a living Constitution and only gives the text of the Constitution, quote, the meaning that it bore when it was adopted by the people in 1787. In contrast, Justice Souter has criticized this purely textual approach as having, quote, only a tenuous connection to reality. He believes that the plain text of the Constitution as written in 1787 does not resolve the conflict in many of today's tough cases. Rather, Justice Souter believes judges must look at the words and see, quote, to understand their meaning for living people. Which view of the constitutional interpretation comes closer to your view? And why?
Senator Cole, I don't really think that this is an either-or choice.
Dahlia Lithwick, what about this notion of a living constitution and this ongoing debate about the role of the Supreme Court and its interpretation and exactly how Elena Kagan does view that role?
Well, I think it goes right back to what Kim just said, which is this is an attempt, I think, on Cole's part at least, and the Democrats generally, to debunk the notion that what conservative jurists do is incredibly narrowed and very easy. You just look at the text, you apply the text. It's like, you know, building an IKEA table. It's just easy peasy, move on. And I think that they've really done, to their credit, an enormous job, a tremendous job in the last couple of decades of selling that vision that we need to constrain judges. They're crazy renegades. And this is the way to do it. You know, it's originalism and it's simple. I think what Justice Souter was doing, and I think that Senator Cole was alluding to the speech he just gave at Harvard, was saying it's just not that simple and that it's very important to constrain judges, but to constrain them by a document that is by definition ambiguous in its terms, that has conflicting provisions within it, different values that are embodied, requires judgment, and that Kagan, I think, has done a fairly good job in the last 2 days of saying it's just not easy, and that it's very, as an aspirational statement, it's very nice to say constitutional interpretation is simple. You just go to the original language and text, and you figure it out, and you make your decision. But if that were the case, we wouldn't need nine justices, and opinions wouldn't go on for hundreds of pages. It's hard, says Kagan, and I think she's right. And I think what she and Souter are trying to do is push back on this idea that when conservatives do justice, it's simple and mechanical, and when liberals do justice, they make stuff up.
Professor Garnett, this ongoing debate of the living Constitution.
Yeah, I think it's worth thinking about, you know, why it is that so many people think they oppose judicial activism. I mean, obviously, many people must, because otherwise nominees wouldn't feel the need to distance themselves from it. And I think the idea here is that people worry about judges who were unelected and so on, taking away from the political process decisions that the people think they should be able to make. So when people on the more progressive side object to decisions by conservative judges, they think this is a mistake. These judges shouldn't take away from Congress the power to respond to problems in campaign finance or problem in the economy. On the conservative side, people are frustrated by the extent to which the court seems to have taken away some very core fundamental moral debates from the political process, debates about abortion, say. Mm-hmm. So the real question isn't who's activist and who's not. Both sides are sometimes and both sides aren't sometimes. The question is, you know, when do we worry most and when should we worry most about judges overriding the results of political and democratic deliberation? Mm-hmm. And that's what the real hard question is here. I think someone on the conservative side would say, look, if the conservative judges get it wrong and overrule, you know, a guns-free school zones protection act provision, that's not the end of the world. Congress can just tweak it and make it constitutional. But when judges constitutionalize the abortion debate, they remove from politics, to an extent anyway, this very divisive question on which reasonable people disagree and so on. That's what the activism fight is about.
Here's another clip from today's hearings where Senator Ted Kaufman from Delaware brings up a recent case decided by the Supreme Court. It's the Citizens United case. Used it as an example of results-oriented judging. And he asked Elena Kagan what she thought of that process.
I think results-oriented judging is pretty much the worst kind of judging there is. I mean, the worst thing that you can say about a judge is that he or she is results-oriented. It suggests that a judge is kind of picking sides irrespective of what the law requires, and that's the absolute antithesis of what a judge should be doing.
Professor Roosevelt, I'll ask you to weigh in on that point.
Well, I certainly would agree with Solicitor General Kagan there. Results-oriented judging is terrible. And I also agree with what I think she's implicitly suggesting, which is that you really don't see that kind of I like a particular outcome, I'm going to vote for it, judging on the Supreme Court. I mean, no one experiences it that way. The justices certainly all believe that they are following consistent philosophies that lead them to particular results, regardless of the political outcome there. And I do think that's true. I think people have different theories of the First Amendment. It's a little bit interesting to contrast the Citizens United case, which takes a very strong, expansive reading of First Amendment rights, with, say, the more recent Holder case about material support to terrorist groups, where the court seemed a bit less protective of speech rights. But, you know, generally speaking, I think everyone is acting in good faith. No one is results-oriented at that sort of narrow partisan level.
I have so many calls in here. I've got to get more in. Sophia is on the line from Des Moines, Iowa. Hi, Sophia. I'm glad you waited. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me. I just wanted to make two different points.
Okay.
The first point is I think that it has been evident that the Republicans have been trying to paint Kagan as some kind of liberal activist, progressive, and I don't think that's the case. She is a Democrat, so she does hold most opinions on the Democratic side, but I think that she will be a consensus builder and kind of more of a pragmatist like our president. And I also think it was a mistake for the Republicans to try to kind of attack her for her work and her admiration for Justice Thurgood Marshall, who is one of the most influential justices we had in the 20th century. And whether or not you agree with him and his views, I think that was a mistake, and most people do respect Thurgood Marshall. And I'll take my comments off the air.
Sophia, thank you. Dahlia Lithwick.
I couldn't agree more. I think that one of the really notable things about yesterday's day two of the hearings was that the full-bore assault on Thurgood Marshall and his legacy dwindled to almost nothing. I mean, on the first day, you heard it and you heard it and you heard it. And I think, as Sophia says, there was an attempt to somehow tether Kagan to Thurgood Marshall's legacy and to suggest, someone yesterday said, oh, Thurgood Marshall, he was the one who believed that you make the law do what you want and then, you know, everything else catches up. And I just think that this relentless assault on him the first day was a terrible mistake, because too many people in this country don't think of Thurgood Marshall and think, I question his judicial integrity. I question the way he approached cases. They think, oh, icon of the civil rights movement. And so assailing him as an attempt to get to her, I think, is both bad tactics, but also really blurs how different she is from Marshall.
Here she is, Dahlia, expressing admiration today for the work of Justice Marshall, of course, who fought hard to overturn the Jim Crow laws. Here she is.
You know, you could walk into the state houses and you could walk into Congress and you can walk into the White House, and there were not a whole lot of people who were willing to listen to the kinds of claims he was making, just claims for racial equality. And I think what he, the reason he revered the courts was that step by step by step over the years, he did find success in the courts because the courts were willing to listen to those claims in a way that nobody else in the governmental system was. And he made great progress and did great justice.
Professor Garnett, the invocation of Thurgood Marshall, what do you make of it?
I agree with Dahlia that it's at the very least tactically unwise, because I think most people do associate Thurgood Marshall with his kind of heroic efforts as a litigator with the NAACP and with all the positive changes he brought about. I mean, it should be fair game, I guess, to point out that his judicial philosophy is one that I think most Americans would feel uncomfortable with. I mean, he did sort of famously say, and maybe he was joking, that he does what he wants and let the law catch up, and that's not a vision of judging that people are attracted to. And Solicitor General Kagan herself even said, look, you're getting me, you're not getting Justice Marshall. I mean, you can never expect, I think a nominee, it's not fair to expect a nominee to criticize in any kind of pointed way his or her mentor. I mean, for those of us who've worked for justices, it's an incredible experience. They changed our lives, and so you can't expect Solicitor General Kagan to criticize the justice. But it should be fair game to talk about that judicial philosophy.
Dahlia Lithwick, in our last couple of minutes here, what kind of cases might Elena Kagan have to recuse herself of because of her current role as Solicitor General?
Well, she was asked that yesterday, and she said there's about 10 cases where she was, you know, because she was Solicitor General and sort of on the record as Solicitor General, she'll have to recuse. And then there are others, she said she didn't delineate how many, that there are others where, you know, she was so involved. She took I think she described the word as sort of active leadership role in those cases. And they tend to be, a lot of them, I think, tend to be war on terror cases. But she said, she certainly suggested yesterday that it isn't thousands and thousands the way some have suggested, that it's a limited set of cases, and that she has in her own mind a clear metric for how she's going to decide which ones she has to recuse and which she doesn't.
Professor Roosevelt, as it stands, it appears that Elena Kagan will indeed be confirmed pending some outrageous event here. But what kind of justice do you think she might be?
Well, I think, you know, at a sort of high level of generality, we can probably be pretty confident she's going to fall on the liberal, or I like to say moderate, side of the court, just because she's an Obama nominee. I think we haven't learned a lot about her otherwise. I do agree with the people who say she comes across as a nice, unpretentious, affable, humorous person. On the other hand, John Roberts did too. I thought John Roberts came across as a delightful person in his hearings. I'm sure he is a delightful person. But he and Elena Kagan will likely be very different justices. And it's one of the defects of the hearings that they actually sound so similar.
Professor Garnett, in the last 30 seconds, you get the last word.
Well, I think Chief Justice Roberts and soon-to-be Justice Kagan will be similar in the sense that they're both charming and intelligent and acting in good faith to decide cases in the appropriate way. But as Kim said, they're going to be on different sides of some hot-button cases. She'll be reliably on the liberal side, just as Chief Justice Roberts is fairly reliably on the conservative side.
Dahlia, actually, I'll let you have the last word. Go ahead.
I agree with everyone's assessment thus far, and I think that she may prove to be a fairly effective consensus builder and vote getter in a way that we haven't seen at the court in a while.
A really insightful conversation on this important event. Dahlia Lithwick, senior editor and legal correspondent for Slate. Dahlia, thanks as always.
Thank you, Jane.
Kermit Roosevelt, professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania. Professor, thanks to you.
Thank you, Jen.
And Richard Garnett, Professor of Law and Associate Dean at Notre Dame Law School. Professor, I appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.